This program is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners. Show your support at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This week on Meet in Three, we look at the ways indoor and outdoor spaces are being reconceptualized during the pandemic to better suit new modes of living, working, and eating.
It's brought a vibrancy and an energy back to the city streets that were so dearly missed during the height of the pandemic.
This is about how we can grow indoors all year round using proprietary technology that we've developed.
How do I have someone understand, look, don't take a next to the Juneberries because you can eat those. That's free food.
Tune in to Meet in Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Bob Valgenti, standing in for Coral Lee. This episode is part of a special series in collaboration with Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies, whose most recent issue is entirely devoted to COVID dispatches. In it, authors from around the world offer short, intimate portraits of early responses to the food crises of this pandemic. For this podcast series, hosts from the journal's editorial collective are joined by some of the featured authors to share their stories and to hear how things have progressed since their original submissions in March and April of 2020. My guest this week is Dr. Soumya Gupta, whose essay, Lockdown Destitution, Delhi, March 2020, appears in our most recent issue of Gastronomica. Dr. Gupta is Assistant Professor of History at the University of Delhi, teaching at Janki Devi Memorial College. Her specialization is on modern Indian history, and she has a PhD on Kanpur, an industrial city in northern India. Her current research focuses on the social history of cooking in North India, and in particular, on the Hindi cookbooks. She has been awarded an Indo-Japanese bilateral collaboration grant, along with Riho Isaka of the Tokyo University, for researching ideas of food and body in India from medieval to contemporary times. And she is also co-investigator for the AHRC-GCRF project on Forgotten Foods, led by Siobhan Hurley of the University of Sheffield. She has published book chapters and journal articles on the partition of India and North Indian foodways, and is preparing her monograph on Kanpur for publication. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you for having me.
So let's start off traveling back in time, if you will, to March of 2020, when this all began. As a historian, and at this historical moment, what inspired you to document this particular moment of the pandemic?
My submission to Gastronomica was more of a gut reaction to the, this absolutely strange situation that was unfolding around us, and to the, absolutely sudden destitution that it brought in India. And this destitution, it was very clear right from the beginning, was induced as much by state policies as by the epidemic. So when this call came, I was at that moment, thinking about and talking to a lot of my students, and who belong to poorer families. I teach in a public university, and they come from families which were usually the underclass, the laboring poor of the city of Delhi. So it was that 1 week of the first lockdown in India, which started in March, on March 24, that 1 week laid bare all the iniquities that were hidden under the cosmopolitan gloss of Delhi. So it was, that moment which just led me to write that piece.
Right. And, this is in many ways a common theme we've seen across the world, how the pandemic has exposed the inequities and some of the social issues that had been there all along under the surface. But for you especially, was it this impending humanitarian crisis as it was unfolding at that moment, you know, far beyond just what the disease was going to produce? Was this what gave you that initial reaction, made you see quite quickly that this was going to be, a rather momentous problem?
Yes, because, as I told you, I teach in a public university. I teach undergraduate students, and many of these students were first-generation learners. So, as we were battling this pandemic, and at that moment, it was not very sure whether we were going to go online or how we were going to do, all around us, I was getting these calls from students whose parents were losing job, and they were calling me to say, we are making the trek home, going back. And so, it was very evident that this kind of an absolute destitution, which had been forced upon people, when actually nobody knew what is going to be how it's going to pan out, the whole pandemic. In fact, people did not even know at that point in India that, what is happening around us, because just we had elections in Delhi and there were a lot of protests that were happening just before that. So this was very new, and it was completely forced. And as somebody working with young students, somebody teaching history, modern Indian history, it just completely dawned upon us that we are living through a time which is extremely distressful, and is going to be difficult for everybody around us.
And I think what you captured rather quite nicely in your dispatch is both the scope of the unfolding situation and how vast it was, given particularly the population in India, but that you also chose to frame the essay from the perspective of one individual. So with that in mind, perhaps it would be a good thing for you to share your dispatch with us.
Yes, of course. Lockdown destitution, Delhi, March 2020. In a maximal response to the COVID-19 pandemic, the Indian government declared a national lockdown on March 24, 2020. As the lockdown unfolded over the next week, Reema, a distraught Delhi University student, called her teacher. She wanted assistance in organizing food rations in her neighborhood in Rani Bagh, a lower-class colony in East Delhi. Her reasonably comfortable family had helped some people, but the numbers continued to increase, as word traveled of Reema's effort to help her neighbors. Migrant laborers and daily wage workers in the neighborhood dropped their phone numbers on chits of paper through her window. These mobile phone numbers were silent inscriptions of their existence and of their hunger, a veritable SOS call from a sinking ship. Soon, there were about 150 number chits floating around. Every number represented a family, potentially 5 to 7 famished mouths with no recourse to food or succor. Even though the state government of Delhi had started soup kitchens in municipal schools and night shelters, Reema was concerned about overcrowding, mindful of the medical directive of social distancing to flatten the curve of the virus. But social distance was a privilege that the poor could little afford. Moreover, among those desperately thronging her house were pregnant women, people with disabled children or old parents, and people who are unlikely to be successful in the crowded melee around the food charities. These were working-class families that formed the underbelly of the great cosmopolitan city of Delhi. They ferried noodle carts and dumpling stalls, worked as delivery boys, or were employed as maids and cooks in the neighboring middle-class apartment blocks. Most of them were, ironically, in the business of food. Those who had a daily relationship with food were now most distanced from it. For these working-class people who valued their labor, charity was dehumanizing. Hunger, in all its rawness, propelled the great migration out of the city. With no work and little hope, the village they all had left behind beckoned to them. The village has the farms, the field that will give us food. This had been the overwhelming refrain from the scores of migrant workers who are walking back home. As one said, home is where you go back to, where there is food. It has taken a pandemic to dent the victorious narrative of capitalism and its talk of progress, development, and plenty. There is no way of evading the fact that the lockdown imposed by the central government, though necessary, was almost totally unplanned. There was no meeting of the cabinet. Even union ministers were not taken on board, nor was there any consultation with state chief ministers who were left to fend for their states as they could. Whereas the government repatriated the corona-afflicted elites, the undiseased poor were denied trains and bus services to their homes. There was a four-hour window between the prime-time announcement of the lockdown at 8 p.m. and when it went into effect at midnight. The result was panic buying and panic travel, all a result of panic governance. The government did announce that essential services and supply chains would remain open. However, no clear direction was given with regard to market linkages and supply chains of food provisioning. The result was thousands of stranded supply trucks loaded with goods stuck on highways. They produce rotting. Almost 50% of the trucks were abandoned by the drivers and cleaners who joined the journey back to the village. Even when some commodities did reach the destinations, there were no workers to unload them. Indeed, in various wholesale markets where shops were ordered to stay open for 8 hours, the traders closed their shutters in two and went home. Food aggregators like Grofers, Big Baskets, and Amazon Now that supply metropolitan middle classes were running at about 10% capacity due to the departure of informal labor. And those delivery persons who did venture out were brutally beaten by the police in blanket adherence to the order. Stories in the press and through that great communication channel of our age, WhatsApp, have progressively taken on the hues of the apocalyptic. There is increasing fatalism among India's poor laboring class who wonder whether the disease or hunger would get them first. Part of the invisible underclass running the cities, their exodus has made them perhaps more visible than at any other time. However, even though COVID-19 hitched a ride via the affluent, the poor are quickly labeled as potential carriers of disease. As a darkly humorous WhatsApp line had it, the ration cards, within quotes, are paying for the mistakes made by the passports. Beaten back from the borders of the cities, given a chemical wash before allowed entry into the small towns, the lucky ones who reach their villages have become a source of anxiety there. But as one of them put it, if one has to die, one should die at home. Back in Rani Bagh, contribution arranged, a local grocer roped in, Reema decided to distribute dry rations for a week. The contribution per family would come to ₹890. Which the grocer subsidized to ₹690, less than $10. Reema's efforts meant succor for a week. The lockdown was to continue for another two. No one was sure how long the grocer's stores or middle-class charity would last. The future threatened to be diseased and hungry. Little wonder that the central government ordered a re-telecast of the 1980s devotional blockbusters, the Ramayana and Mahabharata, on national television, possibly hoping the gods would help people forget what it could not manage or mitigate.
Thank you for sharing your dispatch with us. We are going to take a short break, and then we'll return to our interview with Dr. Soumya Gupta. You are listening to Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy, despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new show.
And we're back. I'm Bob Valgenti, standing in for Cora Lee. My guest is Soumya Gupta, who shared her essay, Lockdown Destitution, Delhi, March 2020, just before the break. So what are the questions that we've been asking of all of the writers of our dispatches has been to think about the degree to which things have changed since you wrote this. This was written all the way back in March of this year, and undoubtedly a lot has changed both in India and across the globe. So I'm wondering if you could maybe walk us through a few of the changes, maybe starting with the way that you begin the essay, which is talking about a student who's trying to do something in the face of the pandemic. So at that personal level, for maybe some of the students that you work with, or perhaps others that you come in contact with, how has the day-to-day life of the pandemic changed since that time?
Actually, there has been, you know, I can figure on two kinds of changes. One is, you know, if you see, the lockdowns have now progressively been lifted. But, you know, so people are out on the streets. They are, you know, many of them are going about their business. There are some restrictions in place, but economic activity has started. Though economic distress is here to stay because most people have lost jobs, and especially the working classes have lost more than, you know, the middle classes in India. Now, as far as the students are concerned, you know, from where I started the story, and as we as educators, as we are grappling with teaching online and they are grappling with studying online, the stark reality of the digital divide is there to stare at us. You know, usually there is only one smartphone with a lot of my students and very, very limited amount of data. And this is one smartphone in a family. You know, so it's a very scary scenario. There are so many students, especially women students, who are forced to give up on college education, and many more who will not be able to enter the university in the coming years. So this has been a particularly heavy toll of the pandemic. Unfortunately, most of the solutions, especially in the universities that have come up, have been very managerial, you know, techno-managerial. We have to really redefine what we are teaching, reconfigure the certainties of our syllabus and our pedagogy, because as I'm speaking and as I'm teaching, we find that there is the hopelessness of what is happening is slowly dawning over people. Even as I said, restrictions are easing, people are back on the roads. You know, a lot of enterprises are starting, etc. But there is this problem that is there. And the other thing I would like to flag is, you know, in India as elsewhere, a public university like Delhi University provides a new kind of socialization to the young. You make friends across the divides, whether it's class or caste or region. And young people who should have been looking forward to college education to break out of the cycle of poverty, to dream of their new life, new affinities. All of these have to wait for some more time to come. And frankly, time is not a privilege the poor have. You know, so a lot of them are going into employment, whatever local, very seasonal jobs that they can manage, because survival is at risk.
Do you think there are particular measures that have been taken that have, rather than mitigate some of those divides, have actually exacerbated them? So choices, whether they're at the level of the government or somewhere below that, that have actually worsened some of the divides that are there?
I think that the divides have been worse. For example, almost all schools and colleges have gone on with online teaching, which is one way to cope, but obviously very difficult to participate in if you don't have the devices. Let me give you just one example from exactly here. The teachers of Delhi universities, and the student body all asked for the terminal year examinations to not take place, because our logic was that, you know, these were students we had evaluated for over 5 semesters, and we can actually calibrate their marks and promote them to the next basically give them the degrees. This was turned down by the highest body, the University Grants Commission, as also by the courts. And what happened was then, when we were doing online examination and when a lot of us were then evaluating, what we were evaluating was privilege. Because, you could make out that there were scripts in which the students, these were off, open book examinations, which were done sitting at homes. And only those who had the requisite amount of data could actually take these examinations. So the university is forced to now again redo the examinations for those who were not able to give it, precisely because of these problems. Similarly, if you have issues that are coming up with traders, where, as I mentioned in my dispatch also, the provisioning, the supply chains were really not thought about. So it was very difficult for either the retail sector to stand on its own feet. The neighborhood shops were at the mercy of these rules. And the implementation of rules was extremely draconian. So you've had people beaten up on the roads by the police if they were going out to buy milk for their children. There was no other way of, and this was all done in the name of safety, security. The manner in which, in fact, surveillance, there is a normalization of surveillance due to this pandemic has been quite, has been noted here, because this surveillance has come both from the community, from people, from gated communities, who have erected these huge walls of separation, exclusion, and from the government's policies also. So in the name of safety, the authoritarian state, in fact, has, strengthened the chains of surveillance all around.
Yeah, that certainly seems to be a concern in many places. And I wonder, you used the phrase early on in your dispatch saying that the government seemed to be ruling by panic. And would you say that since that time, that the response by the government in particular, whether it's in terms of surveillance or in terms of other moves that seem to have strengthened some of the divides, that it's gone from a sort of panic response to a more thought out, but unfortunately, perhaps somewhat more heavy-handed approach to managing the population?
Yes, I think you're right, absolutely right there, because, as I said, surveillance is progressively being normalized. So the kind of opposition there would have been to some of these technological surveillance is, in fact, dealt with a very heavy hand. And, it is now, and the middle class, it's not just the government now, the middle classes have also got into it. And we find that there are now multiple gated communities across the city and in most cities of India at the moment. We are actually seeing something else which is very interesting. It is that as you're going into the interior, there the fear of the pandemic is somehow decreasing. Mm-hmm. As the death rate is rising, if you follow Indian politics, you would find that one of the most, populous states, the state of Bihar, is going to have its provincial elections in about 3 days. And as we are watching on a TV screen, you know, the election rallies have thousands and thousands of people all teeming without masks. It is, you know, as if people have decided that, you know, there is, since there's no cure is coming, the fear of the, you know, the social fear of the pandemic is also somehow, they've put it behind themselves. Mm-hmm. And we are still trying to read what is happening, you know, because a lot of them, a lot of this crowd comprises those who walked back, trekked back to their homes in March. And they are now there without jobs, without any, you know, hope of getting a job. And they are also participating in this political process, you know, fearlessly, so, in fact.
Yeah, and this is one of the things I wanted to ask to follow up on your essay. So with that population, many of whom made the trek back home, they've been there for that extended period of time. So it seems that there's perhaps some degree of fatigue, some degree of complacency that comes just through the impulse to try and normalize things. But this is all happening not just right before this election, but has it also been the case, if I'm not mistaken, that there's been a significant increase in the infection rate in India over the past month or so?
There has been a significant increase in the infection rate. But, you know, India being the huge country it is, there are still pockets in which the death rate is not that high, you know. So the infection rate is very high, but somehow we have managed, to keep the death rate under some kind of control. I wouldn't say a lot of control. Also, see, for the poor of India, I always think that dying is actually quite normal in many cases, you know. So there are deaths that are happening, to distress across board. And what has happened is with the kind of destitution that has set in, the fear of dying through this disease is somehow, being pushed back to the pushed back in their daily life, etc. And so which is, you know, before the pandemic is ending medically. In fact, another very interesting thing that has happened is that the government has made actually politicized the vaccine. It is the incumbent government has said that if you vote for us, you know, once we come to power, we'll give you free vaccine. And you can imagine that there is a lot of furore that is going on in India at the moment because, you know, I mean, the vaccine should be free for everybody. It should be part of the universal program. It should not be part of a political program of a particular party, any party.
Yeah, and this, you know, the it seems to be an earmark of governments that are, you know, perhaps managing this crisis in an ad hoc way, as we in the States have been subject to the same sort of politicization of the vaccine and of other aspects of this. But there's also an interesting historical link here that's connected to some of your research. So I was wondering if you could shed some light on how history, and particularly the history of India in dealing with plague, has shed some extra light on perhaps what's going on now and how both individuals and groups and the government as a whole are responding to the crisis.
So, as you mentioned in the beginning when you introduced me, I did a PhD on a city in Kanpur, and this was an industrial city at the turn of the century. It was one of the biggest cities manufacturing cloth. It was known as Manchester of the East, and at the turn of the century, when the 1895 to 97, there was the outbreak of plague in Bombay. And that, at that point of time, there was a lot of these plague regulations were put in. And what happened was that there was similar panic. You know, in fact, the first sedition case in India in colonial times was when the plague commissioner of Pune in Bombay state was gunned down because of the plague regulations. This was in 1897. And ultimately, what happened was that many workers from the cities of Bombay, Pune, Calcutta rushed home, like today, rushed to the interiors, to their own villages to escape the plague. And Kanpur was one such city in northern India. And here, as the government put in the restrictions, we find that there was in April 1900, there was a riot. In fact, a series of riots that broke out precisely on how draconian the plague regulations were. And this happened when actually there were only 3 to 6 cases of plague in the city. Just the idea and the news, these kinds of regulations are going to come in, and that these regulations are going to involve segregation. You are going to be taken to plague huts, as they were called. Women were going to be, subjected to Western medical inspection, etc. We see that there's a huge riot, and the seriousness of the riot was such that the colonial government in the United Provinces actually, took back most of the draconian provisions of the plague regulations. So what happened then was that the plague surged even then, but the regulations were watered down. Today in India, we are actually dealing with the plague law that is used is the same plague law. It's the Epidemic Diseases Act 1897. And it's the same kind of laws that are put in place, the same restrictions, the same word. This word quarantine, is coming totally from the plague restrictions of 1897, and the government is using exactly the same law. So you can see these various possibilities. One possibility which I found very, very interesting was that, about 2 months into the pandemic now, when it was pretty clear that governments or medicine do not have a cure. On television screens, we found news reports coming of people worshipping the goddess Corona. And again, there is a parallel to the early 20th century where, this kinds of, you would try to propitiate the goddess to deal with the disease. Because how does one deal with a disease that cannot be tamed by science? And here also, when governments or doctors were unable to save lives, whether it was in 1900 or 2020, we found that people were turning to gods. And there has been a long tradition of propitiating pathogen, in India. And there were stories about, for example, the most famous of such goddesses was the Shitala Mata. And Shitala was the goddess that could cure and cause the smallpox. And earlier when I was younger, when I was studying, I had read about this and heard it from older people in the family. And frankly, usually the response was a very dismissive kind of snigger, at these superstitions. And now, it has been a learning experience because we have these reports of women in interior worshipping the goddess Corona. So Corona Mata would be Mother Corona, which would be an exact translation. And frankly, I think our snigger is tamed now. The pandemic has taught us that it is in fact, in some senses, a lesson in collective mentality for many of us who dismissed these ways of dealing with anxiety, of fear, when there is obviously no hope left. So it's been quite interesting in that sense.
Yeah, so the repetition of history,
yes,
is oftentimes seen as something happening out there, is perhaps this kind of collective psychological response to the desire to have, sort of a normal life back and to work even something as powerful as death back into the fabric of everyday life. I wonder if in all of those interesting similarities, maybe as a way to also bring us to a close of this interview, if there's an important difference that you've seen, either in the comparison to the plague back at the turn of the 20th century, or in terms of some of the other historical responses to these types of pandemics and government measures.
So one thing which is different from what, how this disease was seen earlier and is seen now is that there is still, despite this kind of going back to an older remembered way of dealing with the pandemic, which I just mentioned, there is a belief that ultimately science is going to cure. So, you know, some things have changed fundamentally. The fact that governments can, promise vaccine and the fact that people are looking forward to that is a very, very big change from the earlier times. And I think there it is there that you can read some kind of a hope that things have changed and maybe there will be a change for the better, hopefully sooner than later.
And perhaps on that optimistic note, that's where we can end this podcast. So Dr. Soumya Gupta, thank you so much for sharing your dispatch with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me here.
The COVID Dispatches series is produced in partnership with Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies. More essays like the ones shared today can be found in issue 20.3, now available on the journal's University of California Press website. Meant to be eaten, listeners can enjoy 30% off single print copies of this issue with the discount code GastroAug2020, all caps, all one word. And that offer is valid through June of 2021. Stay tuned to the Heritage Radio Network for more COVID dispatches on this podcast, Meant to be Eaten. I'm Bob Valgenti, and on behalf of the Gastronomica Editorial Collective, thanks for listening.
Meant to be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.